From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. It's not enough to say the words. It's time to do the work. That's the message from gun control advocates in a letter today to President Biden. They're urging him to take executive action and work with Congress to reduce gun violence. This comes as the nation continues to grieve two mass shootings within a week in Atlanta and Boulder. Biden has called for renewing a federal assault weapons ban and for more rigorous background checks. But getting those measures through Congress would be difficult, even though a majority of Americans now favor universal background checks. That includes our next guest, Paul Kemp, who is also a gun owner. He's co-founder of Gun Owners for Responsible Ownership. He started the group after his brother-in-law, Steve Forsyth, was killed by a gunman at a mall in Clackamas County, Oregon, in 2012. Paul, welcome to Here and Now, and I'm so sorry for your family's loss. I know the pain doesn't go away.
No, it doesn't. Kind of gets renewed with each shooting, but thanks for having me.
We're glad to have you. You say that you have owned guns for most of your own life, and you don't want all gun owners to be demonized for the actions of a few. But considering that your brother-in-law, Steve, was killed by a gunman who used a similar style gun to the AR-15, I wonder why your group does not support banning them.
Well, there's so many of them in the marketplace at this point, and private ownership. You know, I'm not sure what the right mechanism is, but our position has been, you know, in 1934, they passed the National Firearms Act, and that one governs silencers and machine guns and other high-powered rifles that the government didn't want the general public to have. And it's withstood every court challenge. It works. So that's one avenue, is to make those weapons fall under the regulations and rules of the NFA of 1934. We also had a 10-year ban from 1994 to 2004. And that worked, and it made a significant dent in shootings that involved assault-style weapons. So, you know, we have two areas to look at, and we both know we have a law that works, and it's not enacting a new law. It's a law that works and has been on the books.
But I want to talk about safe gun ownership, because I know that's a focus of your group. And I know that you started by wanting to address this mishmash of laws across the country. You felt like some groups were too far right or too far left. So you've really been pushing for safe gun storage to keep guns out of the hands of people with violent inclinations. So what would you like to see on that front?
Well, I mean, yeah, one of the factors in the way the shooter that killed my brother-in-law, Steve, got the weapon was the gun owner was a friend of his, and all his weapons were fully loaded and unsecured. And the shooter knew this. It was a premeditated. He went and bought ammunition and additional high-capacity magazines to use in that Stag 15. So there's a case where, you know, the gunman knew the weapons were unsecured and were easy to get. There was no break-in. You know, you look on the NRA's website, every firearms manufacturer's website, they all tell you to store your weapons locked up and unloaded. The literature you get with a new firearm says the same thing. So nobody's asking anybody to do anything that is not already recommended by the industry and experts in the industry. So we're just reinforcing that, because I think too many people, a small segment, are careless with their weapons.
Well, if you're worried about irresponsible ownership, then I wonder what you make of these figures. We did see a big rise in gun sales during the pandemic. 20 million firearms sold legally in 2020, a big jump over about 12 million in 2019. And the industry estimates 40% of the people who bought guns last year were first-time buyers. So they may be more inexperienced handling their firearms. And we know the pandemic reduced opportunities for them to take safety classes. Does that worry you?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just bringing a firearm into your home, regardless of how skilled you are at the handling of that firearm, you have increased the risk of injury and death to everybody else in that home, period. I mean, that's a risk I take. I'm willing to take it.
Sure. I mean, there's a trade-off that everybody has to make there. But I guess what I'm wondering is whether, if we focus just on the responsible gun ownership, if we're only getting it one piece of the puzzle, because we have seen over time a statistical correlation between more guns and more gun violence, which I suppose is logical. So should part of the effort, in your view, just include reducing the sheer number of guns in this country, which now outnumber the number of people?
Well, I think part of the reason for the increase in firearm ownership is the way firearms are marketed today as a self-protection, and you need this to keep your family safe. I personally, I've never subscribed to that theory. I think it's not worth it. So I think that's just a fear tactic that's used to sell firearms.
Bottom line then, are there just too many guns in this country?
Well, it would seem like it. Like I said, we have more firearms than we have people in this country, especially with the surge in the last year. So I don't think a background check is a big price to pay. I've passed every one of mine. They take minutes. So not a big deal.
Paul Kemp is co-founder of the group Gun Owners for Responsible Ownership. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Chicago suburb of Evanston, Illinois, has approved a first-of-its-kind plan to give housing grants to some of the city's black residents as part of a decade-long program of reparations. The fund will pay $10 million over 10 years to descendants of black residents disenfranchised by segregation and racial injustice, starting with $400,000 in housing grants this year. The Reverend Michael Neighbors is president of the local chapter of the NAACP, and he joins us now for more. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Tanya. I'm happy to be here.
Happy to have you. This call has been going on for decades on the national level. U.S. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee reintroduced legislation just back in January, as she has every legislative session since 1996. Remind people why you feel this is necessary, specifically for the people of Evanston.
Well, that's a great question. And well before then, you probably know that when 4 million people were freed from slavery with the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation, there was a pledge by the government that they would receive, quote, 40 acres and a mule. None of that happened, but what that pledge was a sort of recognition that repair had to be done. That did not happen because after Reconstruction, what was introduced in the Deep South and around other areas in the country was a new form of racism. And it was separate but equal. It was segregation. It was discrimination. And that also hit right here in Evanston. So even though we're a sleepy little hamlet, a university town, just like any other town in the United States, it had all forms of discrimination. And one of them, which was most recognizable, was housing. And that's why we selected housing as the first category or area to concentrate on trying to make repair.
There is some pushback in the city to this measure. Kevin Brown with the Evanston Rejects Racist Reparations Group said conflating housing equity programs with reparations ideologically diminishes the movement at large. His argument is that this program will result in an application process that only black people with high credit would have access to. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I disagree with that fundamentally. Kevin is definitely a friend of mine, and I've known him for just about the entire time that I've been in Evanston, but we don't see eye to eye on this particular issue. And I would argue and contend that a similar argument actually occurred with every kind of advancement in civil rights. When we talk about integrating segregated schools, there were 9 people, young students that participated in Little Rock Central, right? The students. But it opened up the door for integration of the entire school in the years to come. We know that we were not going to be able to help every single African American in Evanston just starting out, but we do believe that we will be able to help every African American in Evanston in the time to come because we've made that first step. And we also believe that there will be significant contributions that will come in from philanthropists and altruists throughout Evanston, Illinois, and the United States when they recognize what we're doing and trying to accomplish. We think that this opens a floodgate for reparations programs that will begin to rise around the nation.
You spoke to this, but Evanston is funding this initiative with the 3% tax collected on the sale of recreational cannabis. The ultimate goal, as you said, is to make Evanston a more equitable place to live. Now that this has passed, how do you envision Evanston to be for Black Americans and really for Evanston residents at large in 5, 10, or 15 years from now?
That's an excellent question, too, Tanya. And let me share with you that I have an affinity and a love for this community that is tremendous. But at the same time, I contend that it is filled with tremendous challenges. So I think that reparations is going to start that ball rolling, and I think that because property is so expensive in Evanston, that this program is going to help to stem the tide of the exodus of blacks that have been forced to leave Evanston because they can't afford to live here anymore. We've got to stop that. And if we're committed to making sure that it is one of the most beautifully diverse places to live in the country, we have to put our money, we have to put our laws, and we have to put our policies where our talk is leading us. And I think that's what's going to happen over the next 5 to 10 years. I think we have just tipped the iceberg in terms of where we're going to be able to go with all of that happening. I hope that's helpful.
That's the Reverend Michael Nabors. He's president of the Evanston, Illinois chapter of the NAACP. Reverend, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya. Have a great day.
Over the past 12 months, we've heard from teachers about leading classes on Zoom and the effects of remote learning on students. A lot has changed this school year, but will any of it stick? We're going to take a look now at how students and educators have adapted. And for more, I'm joined now by Jer View. He's a guidance counselor at Roseville Area High School in Roseville, Minnesota. Jer, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
We're glad to have you, and I want to take us back to a year ago when schools were shutting down, students were beginning to learn at home. Can you fill us in on what was happening at Roseville Area High School, and then how are things now?
I think the initial stages was more of a crisis learning rather than distance learning or e-learning of any magnitude. For the traditional model of in-classroom has shifted to online distance, and many, many people, including educators and parents and students, struggled with that format, for it was never delivered in that capacity ever before.
So it sounds like things are maybe getting a little bit better, but crisis learning is really quite a phrase that suggests, as you might expect, some loss of instruction. And we have data from the McKinsey Research Group that documents this. It shows that out of the classroom learning has led to losses in subjects like math and others. I'm wondering what you are seeing on the ground as far as the pandemic's impact on the students you work with and also their attitudes about this new blended learning environment that we're in.
Everything holds true. There's a lot of loss in education, but at the forefront as a guidance counselor, we also see an uptick in social and emotional concerns. You know, schools have fundamentally been about relationships, and when you take that element out and there's not that component in there anymore, you know, the rise of mental health challenges, the rise of overall well-being takes a toll. And so we've seen just a surge of mental health concerns. Depression has been on the rise and so forth.
I know, Jer, that the Roseville Area School serves both urban and suburban students. It's a pretty diverse school district. I understand about 60% students of color. So what are you focused on now in terms of preparing students for their classes, not only in the coming months, but also in the years ahead? And what are some of the changes that you've been able to implement to help students make their adjustments?
I think that distance learning and remote learning is going to have to stick to a certain degree, simply because it has been a good supplement for some students. We want to be able to try to incorporate that, hopefully with possible fundings from local and government to provide that alternative. The other big component is innovation. You know, innovation seems to have moved from the margins to the center, and teacher has become more creative with designing curriculum to support students in their changing environments or their needs. So I'm hopeful that we can kind of bring forth all the creativity and meet the students where they are, as well as provide the opportunities for them to be the lifelong learners and productive citizens of tomorrow.
You know, I thought you made a really good point a moment ago about how some students have really actually thrived in this remote learning environment. Others have struggled, to be sure, but I think what it underscores is that the sort of traditional one-size-fits-all style of education maybe needs to be rethought. You've sort of had to rethink it by necessity in the past year, but I'm wondering whether you think this is a turning point, a moment to take a more tailored approach to instruction for students going forward.
I'm hopeful that, you know, the pandemic would be the golden opportunity for us to pivot towards a possible reform and create curriculum that is more student-friendly and more flexible. You know, the traditional model has been catered towards a four-year type of setting whereby it limits many of the students who are more hands-on and practical. So hopefully through creativity and innovation, we can find out more about pedagogy and how we can adapt that to meet the needs of our students with respect to their situation and experiences.
You're a guidance counselor, so you are used to answering students' questions. So I want to throw a couple at you. We put out a call to hear from some high school seniors who are preparing for college, thinking about what they're going to do in their next chapter. And we heard back from several of them. So let's take a listen to somebody who's got a question about maybe deferring college acceptance for a gap year.
My name is Zoe Costanza. I'm 18, and I'm from Syracuse, New York. I've been waitlisted at 4 selective colleges. Do I even have a chance of getting in off of a waitlist this year? Do you have any advice for deciding between taking a gap year and attending college next year?
So, Jira, I imagine this is a somewhat common question that you get. What's your guidance for Zoe?
Absolutely. Stay positive and don't give up hope, for you do still have a chance. Don't let that indecision hold you back or consume you, and start thinking of alternatives too.
So Zoe's question was very forward-looking, but I think we should acknowledge, too, that in the moment, this has been a really difficult year for high school students. They've lost out on a lot of the experiences that the rest of us got to enjoy during that period of life. And I want to hear from a student who speaks to that.
My name is Katie Russell. I'm 18 years old, and I'm a senior at Dripping Springs High School from Dripping Springs, Texas. Like many things in the world, my senior experience has been less than what I dreamed. Everything that you look forward to as a senior is canceled. Every pep rally, dance, event, you name it. I, like anyone else, want the experiences that everyone dreams of as a senior.
That's got to be a tough one, Jer. I mean, you can't give these things back to students like Katie. So what do you tell them?
And it's tough because everyone's in the same boat. I often tell students, you know, don't think of what you've missed out, but think of the skills that you have learned. In distance learning, you have learned various skills to move you forward to the collegial world. Skills such as self-awareness, curiosity, as well as self-advocacy skills. So although this chapter has been somewhat dark, look at what you've obtained and move forward with positivity.
You're making me hopeful that maybe this generation of students, although they may have lost out on some experiences and in some cases missed some instruction, that perhaps they're also an unusually resilient generation of students. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. Students are resilient in general, and they can adapt to the ever-changing climate that we throw at them or whatnot. Sometimes we don't credit them as much as we ought to, but they are forward thinkers and they are pure optimistic individuals.
That's Jer View. He's a guidance counselor at Roseville Area High School in Roseville, Minnesota. Jer, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us and to answer students' questions.
Thank you. And as a school counselor, I have to put in my plug. Go Raiders!
We want to hear more now from one student and her teacher about how the year has gone. Janelle Oliseya is a high school senior at the Academy of Arts, Careers, and Technology in Reno, Nevada. Janelle sat down with her English teacher, Greg Burge, to talk about how they've been working to push through some of the challenges and reflect on a few rewarding moments along the way.
What was going through your head when you were trying to figure out how to, like, teach? I can't imagine what was happening. Just tell me about, like, just trying to figure out how this was going to work.
My main concern at that point in time was just, are kids okay? Because there were some kids that weren't. We wanted to make sure that kids were okay because we were starting to get lots of kids in crisis and realizing how much some students rely on school as a place to not just learn, but to eat, to get some kind of social help, to get some sort of outside of their family guidance that they weren't getting. I was more just concerned about my fellow human beings, and I was kind of glad to have a job where I could at least feel like I was trying to reach out and help some people in crisis.
It's a year into this pandemic. I lost part of my junior year, and my senior year is basically non-existent. And my experience as a hybrid student has just been, it's just such a drastic shift in my education. You know, I'm so used to coming to school every day, forming relationships with my peers and my teachers. It's weird. It's definitely something that, like, you don't really prepare for in any way. You just kind of have to go with it.
I got to say, working with you, kiddo, this year has been one of the most rewarding things that I've done. We would meet and talk about your, not essays for my class, but your essays that we're using to get into colleges and get scholarships and all those kinds of things. And it gave me a lot of hope to see that people still cared about learning. In the midst of all this craziness that we're going through, it gave me a little sense of, like, okay, I can still teach. I can work with a kid. That's what I want to do. And so I'm really grateful to you for coming to me and letting me do a little bit of that too and make it feel like, oh yeah, I'm still a teacher. That felt good.
I never wanted to bother you so much when I was doing my college and scholarship essays, because I know, you know, teachers are just going through it this year. It's just so difficult just adapting to everything. But you would always remind me, like, this is why I do what I do.
One thing that I think you guys are going to have is the ability to deal with crisis, which I got to say is probably the number one skill that you need to survive college or anything after high school, right? You guys might be missing out on a few things or a few books, but those books will be there. You can go read those books. You can go learn that skill. That's what college is for. You go continue your education. But the thing that you guys are learning, the survival skills and the ability to withstand disappointments and to make amazing progress in that disappointment. Like, I think when we look historically, we look at our nation, we look at, or the world in general, people who survive are strong. And so I have a lot of faith that you guys are going to be awesome in college.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, I reached out to you like first week of school. As soon as we got to hybrid learning, I was like, Mr. Burge, hi, you don't know me, but I really want to apply to college. I want scholarships. I just became super motivated when I was stuck at home. I was like, there's nothing else I can do. I was like, I mean, I might as well make the most out of this situation. At the same time, it was super overwhelming for me. And, you know, I was just trying to figure out everything with my future, with everything going on. It's just, it's weird to think about the future when you don't even know what's going to happen tomorrow. I got a full ride to Stanford. So
most of the work that we did was over Zoom or over just over the computer. And so you don't have to apologize for taking up my time, but just being able to work with kids with their writing and with their goals is what I love to do. It gave me hope that there's something beyond this for you guys, but for me too.
It's been a journey for both of us, you know.
That's Janelle Oliseya, a high school senior in Reno, Nevada, along with her teacher, Greg Burge. Their story was produced by KUNR's On Gray.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we talk about what we're watching, listening to, or just trying to figure out, like what concert films you should watch if you miss live music, and great books to read alone or in your book club. All of that in around 20 minutes every weekday. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Europe is experiencing what officials call a third wave of the pandemic right now. COVID-19 is killing 20,000 people a week across the continent, and infection rates are spiking in countries like Poland, which reported 34,000 new coronavirus cases today, an all-time high. The BBC's Adam Easton is on Skype from Warsaw. Adam, health officials there have reported more than 60,000 new infections in just the past couple of days. Why such a big jump?
The main reason is the rampant UK variant of the virus, which officials say is now responsible for 4 out of every 5 new cases in Poland. It's highly contagious. It's sweeping throughout the country. It started in northern Poland, and now it's swept throughout the country, as you say. That has caused officials to say, well, we really need to introduce even tougher restrictions, which are the closure of all nurseries, kindergartens, preschools, most non-essential shops, hairdressers, beauticians and the like, and also restricting the numbers of people who can attend church mass over the very popular Easter holiday period here in the deeply Catholic Poland.
Yeah, so a discouraging development as we're trying to get to that light at the end of the tunnel with the vaccination rollout, and yet we're moving the wrong direction in some ways. And as you say, the UK variant is largely to blame for this recent spike. But if we pull the lens back a little bit farther, Adam, we see that Poland has had more than 2 million cases overall and some 50,000 deaths. How is the country's healthcare system managing the pandemic?
It's putting an enormous strain on the healthcare system, as the Prime Minister, Mr. Morawiecki, said, that it's at the limit of its capacity. Individual hospitals are already experiencing shortages, not just of beds or ventilators, but perhaps the bigger problem is of trained staff to actually operate ventilators and other ICU units. The government is considering sending patients to other regions. It's not just Poland, but Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia are also in the middle of their third wave. We've seen Hungary actually draft in healthcare volunteers to help out in their hospitals.
Adam, we've been talking all week about vaccination issues across the European continent. Take us to the ground in Warsaw, where you are. What's the vaccination rollout like in Poland?
It's around about the EU average. It's in the middle of the EU, which, of course, like all other member states of the European Union, has suffered from supply delays of vaccines. And that has caused considerable anguish amongst the authorities and the populations of the countries here. We've had just over 5 million doses administered in Poland, and Poland's got a population of about just under 38 million. There's been some concern, which has been heightened, of course, because of the debate over the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine and whether that may provoke a higher risk of side effects. And Poland never suspended the use of that vaccine, but that whole debate has increased the reluctance of some people in this country to have that vaccine, and people have been basically not turning up. And of course, the main reason for their reluctance, as they say, is potential side effects.
The BBC's Adam Easton with us from Warsaw, telling us about the latest on the pandemic in Poland. Adam, thank you.
Thank you.
When Presbyterian pastor Walter Kim became the first person of color to lead the National Association of Evangelicals, he said he wanted to get beyond the metaphor of culture wars and instead build bridges. But Kim took over the role just last year as we were reaching new heights of political polarization in this country, and being an evangelical was becoming an even more controversial label. Well, now, as Kim enters his second year as the organization's leader, he's been thinking deeply about the path forward for evangelical Christians. And Walter Kim joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
Yes. For the last few years, Christians have increasingly been asking themselves what it means to be an evangelical today. How do you answer that question for yourself?
Tanya, not having grown up in an evangelical tradition, I came to faith in high school. And I recognized within the tradition of evangelicalism a deep commitment to scripture, to personal transformation of Jesus. And those are the elements that drew me to evangelicalism. I need to say that my father was a refugee who escaped communist China and literally crossed a river in a barrel. When my family immigrated to America, Irish Catholic family welcomed us, and we lived with them for many years. A Lutheran pastor helped broker that transition of my parents from Korea to America. So people of faith have been deeply a part of my own family history in terms of welcoming us to America. I think as a person of color, there's a recognition that at the NAE at this particular moment, we need to work out what it means to have that kind of hospitality that can reach across differences that right now seem insurmountable in a time of tremendous polarization, because we recognize that evangelicalism has often been associated with political identity, with certain cultural stands, with a sense of hypocrisy between what the moral witness and character is of evangelicalism versus its statement.
You've been having a lot of conversations about identity and faith. A few facts here. 1 in 3 American evangelicals identify as a person of color, but a lot of emphasis has been put on white evangelicals, in part because of political divisions that were laid bare during the Trump administration. How do you even begin to move beyond the cultural wars, as you call it, and build this bridge that you describe?
I think part of it is recognizing that there's a much richer history than the current narrative is unfolding. You know, the term white evangelical gets a lot of press, and understandably so, given the political dynamics of what we've experienced the last several years. But evangelicalism, as you've noted, is incredibly diverse. One evangelical denomination, the Assemblies of God, is nearing a 50-50 mark, and that is 50% white congregants and 50% congregants and churches of color. And that's a remarkable inflection point that we're facing. But a part of evangelical history should be noted that we as evangelicals have engaged in issues of racial justice and reconciliation at various points. In 1912, the second conference of the NAACP was hosted at Park Street Church, a flagship evangelical church in Boston. I know this because I used to pastor at that church. And the first chartered group of the NAACP, the Boston group, came out of that conference hosted at Park Street Church. So there is a stream of evangelicalism that has been deeply engaged in issues of racial justice and reconciliation.
Have you had a chance to talk with Black and Latinx and Asian evangelicals about the state of the movement right now? And if so, what are they telling you about how they feel? Understanding the context of the past and those instances where there have been racial justice movements.
Yeah, I think these conversations are incredibly painful, and that has to be named. But there's also recognition that oftentimes these conversations have been conducted in a manner that primarily results in assimilation to a dominant white culture. And we're seeing a moment of reckoning in which, what does it look like to not just have a diversity of color sitting in the pews, but a diversity of culture? Where we engage meaningfully and in solidarity with the vastly different life experiences and expressions of faith. And that's extraordinarily difficult to do. I mean, if we could have solved this problem, it would have been solved already. But one that I think faith is well equipped to address, even if faith hasn't always addressed it well.
Matt Lewis with The Daily Beast wrote about how some evangelicals feel like many leaders in the movement have sacrificed their credibility and moral high ground by aligning themselves with former President Donald Trump. What is the temperature like now, post-presidential election, specifically within the National Association of Evangelicals, now that Trump has lost?
We've distinctly not entered into the political dimensions of faith in terms of, you know, endorsements and political statements that would support one candidate or not. We certainly engage in policy issues that pertain to expressions of faith and justice. And so when we talk about evangelicalism, certainly within the NAE, we're already talking about a situation in which there's indeed a variety of expressions politically. I do think in the broader evangelical community, there is a deep soul searching, again, on what is the appropriate use of power. And how would a follower of Jesus engage in this pluralistic society in constructive dialogue, even as it seeks to challenge and present a faith perspective?
In your work, what does that deep soul searching look like?
Evangelicals are really good at personal transformation. But what you don't see as often is a real robust understanding of the political and public and social and cultural expression and implication of that faith. And in the absence of that kind of strong public theology, that nature abhors a vacuum. So into that vacuum rushes in all sorts of influences. So part of the discussion that I'm encountering right now is, what does it look like for evangelicalism in this moment to strengthen its notion of public theology, its mentoring of the next generation in the public dimensions of faith, so that we're more informed by scripture than we are informed by our social media feed?
I want to ask you about something else before I let you go. You know, the country is mourning the loss of human life after two mass shootings just days of each other. In Atlanta, specifically, where the shooter killed several Asian women, he described himself as having a sex addiction, and his reasons were as an attempt to rid temptation. And we're learning that he went to a Southern Baptist church, not affiliated with your organization. But there are lots of discussions right now about the ways conservative Christian churches preach a kind of purity culture that can cause deep shame and guilt around sexual desire. Is this something that you're thinking about? And if so, how are you advising church leaders to take on this subject?
Yeah, that's a great question. Certainly, in Scripture, there's a very strong emphasis on sexual purity, and we want to maintain that. But there's also a very strong emphasis on grace and the power of redemption that recognizes honest conversation and struggle. So what we don't want to do is marginalize people as they are struggling with all sorts of issues. We want to be, the church needs to be a hospital, a spiritual hospital that engages those who struggle with deep conversation and support. So that's one thing. The second thing is, you know, the motives of an individual are notoriously difficult to ascertain. So honestly, the primary issue that is striking me and many is, how does this connect with the continued racial issues that face our country? Certainly the purity issues are there in the background with this issue as it's continued to be explored. But again, the problems are too complex to isolate to one simple issue. And it's going to require us to engage and navigate this complexity with a measure of grace and clarity that's often not demonstrated now.
That's Walter Kim, president of the National Association of Evangelicals. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Tanya.
Remember the days when toys in big box stores were grouped by gender? You could see them a mile away. Dolls in pink dresses and packaging in one aisle, and blue packaging with toy cars and superhero figures in the other. Well, over the years, some of those big box stores have phased out this kind of grouping. But two California lawmakers want to make certain it stays that way by banning large department stores in the state with more than 500 employees from separating toys and childcare items by gender. Assemblymembers Christina Garcia and Evan Lowe are the bill's co-sponsors, and Assemblymember Garcia joins us now. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. So what is the motivation behind this bill? Why is this an issue that's important to you?
I really feel that stores that have been doing this are doing a good job, and we need to make sure all of California gets there. And I'll speak to my own experience as a math student and as a math teacher. I remember being a kid and always wanting to play with Lincoln Logs, and those were boys' toys, so I couldn't play with them. And I would have to kind of create my own, you know, building blocks in different ways when I was a kid. When I became a teacher, I realized that those skills that you pick up playing affect the way you're able to think and work through the math classroom. And so those toys give kids a lot of spatial awareness early on that helps you with geometry. And so it wasn't a coincidence that oftentimes the boys in my classroom were doing better than the girls in my classroom, not because we're born differently, but oftentimes because the toys we're playing with affected our ability to then be students later. And so I just want to make sure students are able to express themselves. Kids are able to play with whatever they want to play and come up with their own decisions and be able to be better students down the road, especially when we're trying to get more girls into science, engineering, and math.
It's interesting what you're saying about what you witnessed in the classroom. What are some other ways that marketing toys for one gender is detrimental to kids?
You know, I think when we're young, we're exploring our realities, and you might not identify with, you know, the doll, you might want to play with the dinosaur. And so I think when you're being told that you have to be a certain way and you don't fully understand that because you don't feel that in your heart, I think you carry that stigma. You start to doubt who you are. And I think you carry that into adulthood. So I think it really does also affect the child's mental health as they're developing when they don't see that whatever the box looks like reflects their feelings or how they identify.
Target and Walmart are two retailers that have already gotten rid of signs that specify which aisles are for girl toys and which are for boys. So if retailers are already changing on their own, why do you think there needs to be a law requiring them to stop?
We want to make sure that it stays that way, and we want to make sure that we accelerate the pace. And so we are very proud of retailers like Walmart and Target, but there's plenty of retailers who haven't moved in that direction. And we want to make it clear in California that we expect everyone to give kids all the opportunities to play with whatever they want to play with, to be the kids that they want to be and explore.
Is this a problem with just stores, though? For instance, the Mr. Potato Head brand was just renamed Potato Head. Do you think this issue goes beyond how these toys are sold in stores? Should there actually be a broader consideration for companies that design toys to rethink how they approach gender?
I think we need to have that discussion in society in general, not just with toys, but with everything that we do out there. And why are we putting these norms or these ideas early on into kids' heads instead of letting them explore and be creative on their own? And so I think that whether it's the signage at the store or these toys like Mr. Potato Head now being Potato Head, I think those are all positive steps in the right direction. I think at the end of the day, the more we allow kids to be creative and explore on their terms, the better leaders we're going to have down the road. And so I think this is a bigger discussion in society that we should be having.
Well, speaking of that bigger discussion, there has been a movement over the last decade to de-emphasize gender, calls for gender-neutral bathrooms. We now have agency to pick our preferred pronouns. And an earlier draft of your bill actually included children's clothing. What do you say to those who feel that this is all political correctness that has gone too far?
You know, what I would say is you could just look at my own experience. You could look at, you know, the fact that I wanted to play with certain toys and I wasn't allowed to. And I still carry that to this day. And whenever I see Legos or Lincoln Logs, I gravitate to those toys and I want to play with them. And thankfully, I was creative enough and figured out in another way. But if I didn't have that spatial awareness, maybe I wouldn't have been that math major. Maybe I wouldn't have been that math teacher. And if you don't see it, you don't believe it. And so being in the classroom, I often had young girls telling me, wow, this is the first time I see a woman in math and maybe I could be a mathematician also. You know, we need to think about how these labels limit us and limit our ability to move forward. Women are half the population. We should be at every table. But if from the very beginning, we're telling ourselves, you can only be at these tables, or the same thing for our boys. I just think that's a really limiting reality for a lot of individuals. And so we're going to move forward. I think we want to be inclusive. I think we want to let kids explore who they want to be. And I think at the end, we're going to be a happier, more productive society.
Christina Garcia is a member of the California Assembly, and she's a co-sponsor of a bill that would ban large retailers from separating toys and childcare items into separate girls and boys sections. Assemblymember Garcia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And a note, if passed, Assembly Bill 1084 would go into effect January 1st, 2024, and would charge retailers who violate the law a $1,000 civil penalty. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. This is Here and Now.